This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We're also streaming on Facebook Live today at radioboston.org, and what we want to talk about is the opioid epidemic, which has touched tens of thousands of people in Massachusetts and around the nation. Almost 2,000 people die of an overdose each year in this state, and that has taken addiction out of the shadows and into the public light. Stories and books tell one of one family after another struggling with a loved one's addiction. Take the recent movie Beautiful Boy, which is based on the story of David Sheff dealing with his son Nick's addiction to crystal meth.
I'm sorry, Dad. Please just give me some fucking money.
Where does this end?
I gotta see this one through. This is kind of working out for me right now. I got 5 days sober.
It doesn't look like it's working out, Nick.
Oh, it doesn't look like it's working out? So what, no. The therapy, huh?
You can come home.
No, that
wouldn't... make it work. Please, Nick. Please.
That's Steve Carell as David Sheff, Timothy Chalamet as Nick in the movie Beautiful Boy. We want to devote our entire show today, the whole hour, to the opioid epidemic and to hearing your stories about dealing with it. With us in studio are two people with firsthand experience. Maureen Cavanaugh, author of the book If You Love Me. It tells the story of her daughter's addiction. She's also the founder and president of Magnolia New Beginnings, a support group for those affected by substance use disorders. Hi, Maureen.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Nice to see you. Also with us, Michael Wilson, director of family services for Bay State Recovery Services. He's author of the book Loving Lions. It details his experience in recovery and his work as a coach with families who are struggling with this. Hi.
How you doing?
Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. Have you been affected by this epidemic? What have you done about it? Where did you find support? What do you think needs to change? And did you or your loved one get effective treatment? Or what do you think of movies like Beautiful Boy? Is it effective? Does it raise awareness? Or do you think it's exploitive? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. And our show is being streamed on Facebook Live, and you can comment there as well. So, Maureen, let's start with you. We just heard that clip from the movie Beautiful Boy. And as a parent, could you identify with the story and with what you were hearing there about maybe if you just come home, it'll be okay?
You know, I hear this all the time because of the support groups that I run. My boundary in my own life was that my daughter could not come home until she had 6 months of sobriety. And I felt like it wouldn't be good for her and it wouldn't be good for me. But that's, you know, everybody makes their own choices. And I always tell people, you have to make that choice that you can live with, because unfortunately, we're losing so many people that whatever you decide, it could be a tragic mistake. But I believe that, you know, the things that he says in that movie, and that one in particular, people hear that all the time. Mm-hmm. I'll just come home. It'll all be different. And, you know, that's not the magic ingredient. The magic ingredient is that willingness to get into recovery and stay there. And there's a lot of hard work behind that.
Did you see the movie?
I did.
Yeah. What'd you think?
There were parts that were really tough to watch, and because it feels so, you know, there were parts I felt very similar to my own life, and parts of the movie that, you know, certainly that resonated with me. Everybody's story is different, but so many similar, you know, so many commonalities as well. So I think it's hard for people to watch that. It's very scary. And the scariest thing is that you look at that family and they're like so many others that did all the right things. And the mistakes they made were not mistakes that were out of neglect. They were choices that were, you know, done because they didn't care. It was everybody is doing the best they can. They love their children, and no one ever thinks this is going to happen.
And this was based on the book that was written several years ago, before we had words like opioid epidemic, before we knew disease and harm reduction, right, and all of these other things. So I'm wondering, Michael Wilson, I mean, tell me what you think. Do you think that what happened in that movie, and I understand you haven't seen it, is that right?
I have not.
You have not seen it, but you know the story.
I will.
The story. Maybe read the book. Maybe. I won't put you on the spot, but you know the story, you know what it is. Do you think that stories like this are helpful and effective in raising awareness about what's going on?
You know, I think they make us they make us think about our own home life. I mean, I'm a parent now. You know, I can even reflect back to when I was active and my family was trying to address my issue. You know, when I was begging to come home, when they were holding the line. And, you know, in hindsight, I reflect back on how grateful I am that they didn't allow me to go through what I was going through in the house with my siblings, with my family. You know, but I think that these movies, the books, all the information that people are putting out there give families an opportunity to consider, you know, what they really do know about their kids, how they are discussing this topic with them, you know, maybe just feeling the failings by watching the movie or reading the book and figuring out what they need to do differently. So, I mean, the more information people have, I think the better off they are.
Right. You know, I think a lot of folks probably struggle with the decision about whether to allow a young person, a child, to live at home when they're struggling with something like this. And Maureen, you made your decision. She needed 6 months before she was allowed to come back to your house. But a lot of folks, I think, that I've heard and I've spoken to and doing stories about this, they say, if I let them stay on the street, they'll die. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, we're worried about
time,
this fentanyl-infused drug epidemic here. What do you say to people?
You know, I'm not quite sure what the exact statistic is, but I've heard that more people are overdosing in their own home than they are on the streets. You know, I think that's a perfectly normal and rational fear, is to think that, you know, if I have eyes on them, that I can help them, I can save them, I could stop it. You know, but statistically, more of these are happening on the couch, in their own bathroom, in their own bedroom, you know, where they feel safe and comfortable to do more than they normally would. That's not to say that if you kick them out, they'll be safer. But I think that, you know, families help as much as they can help, and they need to take a stand when their help is no longer helping. It's just providing a safe environment for them to continue using the way that they do.
Mm-hmm. We want to protect our children. I mean, we protect them from the time that they're born, from before they're born. We try to protect them. And so it's only natural that you'd want your child to be in the house. I think I know just as many people that said, yes, you can come home, and that the children passed away, as I do that they made that hard line in the sand, you know, that they couldn't. And it was actually my daughter's choice, because my proposal to her was, if you get into treatment and you go into sober living, I will help you make sure you have a place, a roof over your head, but it can't be my house until you have 6 months. Mm-hmm. So it ultimately was her decision as to what she felt comfortable doing, and I felt like it was the right decision for me.
I want to make sure we get some callers in, and I want to remind callers that we're asking you to join the conversation. How has this opioid epidemic affected you? Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Lynn is calling from Dorchester. Lynn, you're on the air. Oh, sorry. Lynn is not in. Justin is calling from Salem. Justin, you're on the air.
Hi, I'd just like to say I'm an addict in recovery, and, you know, for anyone out there listening to this, it's not a death sentence. I've had 12 years sober now, and in the spring I'll be earning my master's degree, and it's been a long, hard road, but by no means is it a dark, dead end.
How did you get help, Justin?
I've had So after my dad passed away, I had to take a hard look at my life, and it was at that moment that, you know, I wanted to be sober before he passed away. It didn't work, and it was you know, a tragic event that got me going in the right direction. But you know, prior to that, I had tried detoxes and rehabs and methadone. And nothing really stuck. It never really stuck. And until I had that moment with my father, I had no future in my sight.
All right. Well, Justin, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Michael Wilson, I'm wondering, does Justin's story sound like a lot of people's stories, that sometimes you don't know what it takes for someone to eventually get to recovery? And it depends on the person.
It does. I mean, everybody has their own, you know, ultimate reason for wanting to change. You know, mine had more to do with my children, you know, than Justin said with his father. I think everybody has to have something that drives them. You know, it's a journey into recovery. You know, we talk about the mile into the woods. It's a mile back out of the woods. You know, we go so far into our addiction that, you know, when the time comes to get well, it's a pretty significant journey that does require some motivation, some inspiration.
Mm. I want to just make sure we get this woman on the air. Lynn is calling from Dorchester. Lynn, you're on the air.
Hi. I just want to say that my son died of the heroin overdose at home 15 years ago.
Oh, I'm so sorry. So sorry.
Sexual abuse as a very young child. He survived a suicide epidemic and had PTSD after all that, of course, and used heroin to self-medicate. And it was so
Lynn, are you
so
with
hard
us?
To find a bed. Mm. And I just, this is what I tell people. I say, I feel like there was such stigma and discrimination. Mm-hmm. Gabby Gifford gets shot in the head. An ambulance is called. She gets immediate treatment, heavy-duty treatment, and long-term rehab. That's what an addict is. An addict has a brain disease, and it's just like getting shot in the head. And to recover from that requires everything that Gabby Gifford got.
Right.
And it's just so, it's expensive, but it's saving a life. And $5 billion for a wall, put that into treatment. Mm. Put that into treatment for the opioid crisis.
Well, Lynn, thank you so much for calling to share your story with us, and I'm so sorry about your loss. I want to hear from both Maureen and Michael about this trouble getting treatment and getting effective treatment. Maureen, what advice do you give people?
Unfortunately, it's the time. I mean, in Massachusetts, we're very fortunate because you can get into a detox and you usually can get into treatment, but It's that length of time that we need that we don't have. So 14 days or 21 days is not enough time. And then what happens after that? When you have to, when you know that all this, you know, damage to your life has been done and you're leaving treatment, if do you have a bed in a sober living, in a safe, secure, sober place? Do you have the support system? Are you able to get a job? There's just so many other things that she's absolutely right. There needs to be, because we're going to spend this money anyhow. We're going to spend it on the loss in our people that are employable. We're going to spend it on health care. We're going to spend it on the effects of people, not just overdose and death, but the health effects that of long-term use, that happens with long-term use, and the children that are being born NAS that are being born to and losing their parents and being raised by grandparents. So we have to decide whether we want to put the money in now and give people long-term treatment that actually will help them and support afterwards, or we want to keep doing this in-and-out thing that isn't working.
Right. And I wonder, Michael, you know, Lynn brought up something where she said that her son had gone through a lot of childhood trauma and was likely self-medicating.
Right.
So that sounds like a co-occurring disorder here in terms of mental health and substance use. What about folks who need something like that, which I assume is fairly common? What advice do you tell those people?
Well, I mean, there's the two different pieces, like Maureen was just commenting on. I mean, there's the, you know, the initial clinical services that are required because most people are struggling with co-occurring disorders. You know, beyond that, as Maureen touched on, you know, there's the length of care that's just not adequate at the time. You know, it's people are coming through, and you know, you can get access to a detox or 14 days or 21 days, a combination, but. Beyond that, I think most people feel like once they get that addressed that the other part's not necessary. And, you know, I think that other part is where people are putting their lives back together. They're addressing the lack of life skills and development over the years of self-medicating and not actually facing what they've experienced, be it a trauma or family issues. And so, you know, taking that time, making sure they have access to those services, I mean, systemically, I think it's a little bit broken. I don't think we're effectively treating the entire illness. I think we're treating the medical side of things and leaving out the other portion.
The psychological side of things,
or even just the life development, life skill development, emotional development. You know, people who have been living a certain way of life for a very long time and then are asked to immediately come out of that and just be capable, almost like coming out of prison after 10 years and just being, you know, expected to acclimate extremely quickly and then being punished because you can't.
Right. I want to take another call. Merritt is calling from Martha's Vineyard. Merritt, you're on the air.
Hi, I concur with all of your speakers. My heart goes out to Lynn. Mm-hmm. I guess I feel like I am one of the lucky parents. My son is in jail, and he isn't in a cemetery. Mm. But my frustration is that he would not be in jail if the services actually delivered good services. There's no oversight. They're often publicly, privately funded, and there doesn't seem to be any look internally or externally at how that how those services are applied, who they're applied to, who they're serving, what is the outcome. There doesn't seem to be much hand-holding. You know, as with other diseases where you're really walked through and you're comforted and you're told exactly what your next steps are and what your next moves are. We don't have that, I don't think, anywhere. But what I'm finding on Martha's Vineyard, where so many people spend the summer in this magical, beautiful island, is that what's happening on the island for year-round residents looks very different. And I will take your answers or your responses to that.
I'm sorry to hear about your son. You might be fortunate that he is still with us, but it is unfortunate that he is in jail, and it is unfortunate that you've had to struggle to get effective treatment. And I want to bring in a caller right now who's on the line waiting to talk about this with us, because she's been working in treatment for quite some time. She's Dr. Ruth Potee. She's a family doctor and addiction specialist at Valley Medical Group in Greenfield. She's also the medical director at the Franklin County Jail. Dr. Potee, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Deborah. Hi, Maureen. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
So we just heard, I don't know if you heard the call, we heard from Merritt in Martha's Vineyard, who said that while she feels fortunate that her son is still breathing, he's struggling, he's in jail, and she thinks that could have been prevented had he had proper treatment. Do you hear that quite frequently? Is that a common scenario, Dr. Potee? Do we have a broken treatment system, as everyone seems to be saying today?
You hear that, and it's never less appalling every time you hear it, because no one should have to go to be incarcerated to get treatment for their addiction. That makes, I think, everybody who's listening to this thinks that is not acceptable practice. And I think the way that Merritt describes it is true. I mean, it is a little bit of a wilderness out there, and even for people like Maureen and Michael and myself who work in the field, we see it on the ground. People who struggle with addiction, a lot of things have gone wrong. It isn't one thing. There isn't one path through it. Many things have to be adjusted in their lives. Many treatments have to be employed to help people get better. It's not an easy disease to treat. There are days as a family physician where I will diagnose somebody with a bad cancer, and then my next patient will be somebody with a bad substance use disorder, and I think to myself, I will have a much easier time helping this person with cancer. They will have a better survival rate than this young person with an opiate use disorder. Mm-hmm. And it's heartbreaking. And so, yeah, the system is not designed to help people who need long-term treatment, which is everybody with a substance use disorder. What it takes to get better is time away from the substance and a whole bunch of other things going your way.
So
my hope is, in Merritt's case, that her son is in a jail that actually provides treatment. Because if we're going to incarcerate people for a substance use disorder, we sure as heck better be providing them with evidence-based care in that facility, trauma-informed treatment, cognitive behavioral treatment, medicines to help with addiction, whatever that is, really good behavioral health interventions and psychiatric care. That are people who are incarcerated deserve that. Mm.
So, you know, I guess, though, you know, there's a lot of money being spent on treatment, right? We're hearing about, I mean, there could be more, no question, but there's a lot of federal money. There's a lot of state money. The governor just put another increase in his budget, and he announced it today. So why can't we help create effective treatment? And how does someone judge, right? I mean, we've got accrediting agencies, we've got state licensing officials. I mean, what's the big obstacle here, Dr. Poche?
Well, I think oftentimes money in the past has gone to beds, this concept of a bed. Bring my person in and magically fix them. And I think as everybody who has had a family member or their personal story of addiction, that doesn't work. Actually, detox, I hate the word detox, because you don't detox off the drug. It eventually leaves your body, but you aren't any better at the end of it. So this notion of a 5 to 7 to 9 day detox is a disaster. Those are people who walk back out and use and then die. So the model that we had previously doesn't work. We need to stabilize people in treatment and with a warm handoff plan for the next level. When I talk to people on day one of walking into a treatment facility, I say, look, this is the very, very first step in a very long journey. And we don't know now where you're going to be in 9 months, but we need to start thinking about the plan that needs to be 15 to 18 months long. And the system isn't designed for that, because if it was designed for that, what we would have is a lot of long-term sober living, structured sober facilities, really well-run, where people had opportunities to do stuff and work and go back to school but be held accountable, and where therapy and exercise and eating well and 12-step recovery and medicines like methadone and buprenorphine and naltrexone were part of the treatment if that's what the patient wanted. And instead, we have very limited availability of that. In fact, many long-term sober livings actually mandate that you can't be on medicine. Mm-hmm. So the three evidence-based treatments we have, most long-term sober livings situations in Massachusetts, the ones not certified by the state, mandate you come in off all your meds. That's ridiculous. If I'd made everybody get off their blood pressure medicines or diabetes medicines before they could go live somewhere, I mean, I would have people incredibly sick out there showing up in the emergency room.
Dr. Poche, we have to take a break, but I'm wondering if you can just stay on the line for a minute and rejoin us. Stay with us. Coming up, we're going to continue taking your calls and your stories about the opioid epidemic. We're going to talk about treatment and hopefully get to potential solutions. Our number is 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. All this hour, we're talking about the opioid epidemic, and we want to hear from you if you can share your story about how you or your family has been affected. We want to talk about the system for treatment for the next few moments. Here are some clips from stories that we've done about addiction treatment.
Tomorrow, you and I could open a house and call it a sober house and do whatever we want.
If we really want to improve public safety, we need to be treating people who suffer from substance addiction humanely, and further punishing and hurting a person is not what they need.
The debate about addiction treatment is what we want to discuss for the next few moments. There are lots of forms of treatment, and joining us in the studio to talk about this, Maureen Cavanaugh, founder and president of Magnolia New Beginnings, which is a support group for people affected by addiction and their families. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Also with us, Michael Wilson, the director of family services for Bay State Recovery Services. He coaches families struggling with addiction. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And Dr. Ruth Poche is a family doctor and addiction specialist in Western Mass. She is on the line as well, talking with us about treatment. Dr. Poche, you still with us?
I still am, yep.
And listeners, we want to invite you into the conversation as well. Do you have questions about how to find treatment and how do you know when treatment is successful? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Share your stories with us. You can send us a tweet as well at Radio Boston, and we are streaming on Facebook Live. So let's talk a little bit about what does treatment look like and what should it look like. Dr. Poche, I just want to go back to you because we were talking with you right before the break about treatment. What advice do you give folks about how to find treatment that might be effective?
Well, it obviously, in Massachusetts, we have more availability of treatment than other states, partly because 97% of us are insured in the state, and that's not true in many places. And treatment's not perfect here, yet I would argue that Vermont and Massachusetts and Rhode Island are the leaders on treatment availability in the country. Treatment comes in different forms. There are a handful of people out there who can somehow magically stop using and go to 90 meetings in 90 days and get better. But opiate use disorder has gotten deeper. It's a more potent addiction than it used to be, partly because the potency of heroin and the availability of fentanyl is so prominent. So I said it earlier, I'm a believer that it takes many things to get better, but included in that mix is the medicines that we might use to help people get stable, whether it's going to a methadone clinic or seeing somebody for buprenorphine, either in primary care or a freestanding clinic, or naltrexone, which comes in a shot form that people call Vivitrol. Mm. I believe that if somebody hasn't tried those medicines and they're still struggling, it might be a really good opportunity to reintroduce them to that concept of where the medicines work. The evidence behind them is that they work 50 to 60% of the time when they're used with all the other stuff that also helps people. And so I don't have a lot of drugs that work 50 to 60% of the time. My antidepressants, you know, work at half that rate. Mm. So these are really effective medicines. And even if somebody says, I tried it before and it didn't work, I will sit there and explore with them. Well, what was that about? What else has changed in your life? Tell me how you were doing this. And is there a way we can think about this differently? Mm. At this point in Massachusetts, very shortly, every jail will be mandated to be doing this. It would be nice if they sort of went along with it, not because they were mandated, but because they understand it's the right thing and they did a good job in treatment of inmates. We've been doing it in Franklin County in Greenfield for the last 3 years and have very good success.
That's because Western Mass is progressive, Dr. Pote. But no, in all seriousness, what about this question, though? When you say mandate, a lot of folks say people can't go into treatment until they're ready, right? It's all about readiness, and that's how you have to guess when someone's ready for treatment. And I wonder, Maureen, if you could tell your personal story, how did you know if your daughter was ready for treatment, and what do you tell parents if they have a loved one, or maybe not even just a parent, maybe just any family member who has a loved one struggling? When do they have to force the issue? How do they force the issue? Can they? What happens there?
I think if I would have waited for my daughter to be ready, she'd be dead. I sectioned my daughter. I had her arrested once as she walked out of a treatment center. She kept trying and trying, and she wasn't ready, but she kept going back in. And eventually, and I don't know what that is, but there was some moment of where she could see the other side of it and then continued to work on her sobriety. And it was a surprise to her, and it was a surprise to me, because when I finished the book, she was 3 days out of the last treatment center, and if history was any indicator, she would have been back in 7 days later. But she wanted not to continue with the cycle, but she couldn't seem to break loose of it. And I'm not really exactly sure what happened, but she was able to put one foot in front of the other, and with the thank God for Vivitrol, because that made her it gave her a safety net. And with that safety net, she started to go to counseling and therapy. And she found a fantastic therapist that helped her deal with the trauma and the PTSD from what happened while she was using. Mm. Not necessarily talk about trauma, but it wasn't the trauma before the addiction. It was the trauma during the addiction that kept making her go back, and this feeling that she could never fix it. And so with the help of Vivitrol and the inability to go to relapse, she was able to go and work on herself. Yeah. And I thank God that she has 20 months of sobriety now.
20 months. Congratulations.
Yeah. It's pretty incredible. But I think we have to – it's very important that we talk about the recovery, because we talk so much about death because it's so horrible and frightening and so many people are losing their lives. But by the same token, there are many, many people that are living in recovery right now. I think it's 23.5 million, and I'm sure that's grossly underestimated. And there would be more if we supported them while they were struggling to get to the point where they were able to do it on their own.
Right. I just want to go back to this idea of being ready. Michael Wilson, what do you tell patients about, you know, I don't know. It sounds like it might not be a common scenario for someone to say, yes, that's it. I'm ready. Send me to treatment. Okay, here I go. I'm going to engage and everything's going to be okay, right? That probably doesn't happen.
True. Well, I mean, I'll tell you this. I mean, I'm an interventionist, so I get calls from people who have a loved one that isn't ready. I never get the calls for people who are ready because they have no reason to call me. But, you know, when they do call, they're calling with, you know, fear and desperation that they want their loved one into treatment because they're watching their lives fall apart right in front of them. And, you know, as Maureen mentioned, that if they're waiting until their loved one is ready, they might not survive. And so myself and most of the people that I know in recovery didn't realize they were ready until they were already in treatment and could reflect back in hindsight and compare what they currently have to what they were doing before. And that they had the cognitive ability to make a better decision about what they wanted in their life. I mean, to expect somebody that's, you know, actively using drugs or alcohol, somebody who's completely lost in their addiction, if you're waiting for them to make a good decision, I think you might be waiting for something that won't happen.
I want to take some calls. Bobby is calling from Alston. Bobby, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me. Just wanted to mention, I'm 10 years sober.
Congratulations.
I was an heroin addict, currently now a social worker, and I work in the field. I just wanted to echo a couple of great comments that your panel made. The first 6 days are incredibly important, but even more so is the first 6 months. And what I find to be lacking right now, as was said earlier, is long-term treatment programs. And so I think that the money should really be going towards long-term programs and also making sure that be an eye on those programs so they're operating the way that they should be operating, and really focusing on, you know, transferring folks to a higher level of care whenever they're ready. And I just really want to mention before I go, I think it's important to note that, you know, this, we call this an epidemic, and it is, but it's been an epidemic for 20 or 30 years. It's just the demographics are changing slightly, and that's why I believe it's you know, I got more of a focus now. So I think that it's been proven that the way we're doing business is not working. So, you know, we need to do a lot of things, you know, mass incarceration, regulating doctors, pharmaceutical companies, offering long-term treatment, and really starting to give the folks the resources that they need to survive no matter how much money they have.
All right, Bobby, thank you so much for the call. Thank you. I want to now go to John, who's calling from Peabody. John, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me okay?
I can.
All right. So my sister's been using for closer to 30 years now, and she's dodged a lot of bullets, had a lot of blessings. She's been in and out of prison. She was never clean in prison. She always found a way to get it. Up until the most recent two-year stint, she just got out last year. And she got out in a special treatment program through a program. She lives in California. And it was the first time she's been clean pretty much my entire life, almost. And I was really happy. She would call me every day. And she really started to look at things different. She could see other people, the way they were nodding off, things that she never expressed before. And any attempt to be clean. And as soon as that six-month program ended, she got out, she drove home, she used that day. And then she continued to talk to me, and I've always talked openly, trying to discover and everything. And I found myself very upset, realizing that they just opened the door and said, go. They didn't give her a pamphlet about, here's some NA places in your area. There was no follow-up. Like, people even with behavior problems, like that I've had experience with, they leave and they get a list of therapists in the area. They get a list of partial treatments that they have to still follow so that it's not just your in-house treatment and you're gone. And there's meetings they can go to, nothing.
Right.
And at this point, like, I tried really hard. Her friends that used, they were at her door right away, and she's pretty much gone at this point. We don't talk almost at all. She's actually mad at me because I held up a mirror and tried to get her to understand the consequences around her, but there's, like, I'm always struggling, besides my anger at the system, is, do I cut you off because I can't get you to see, or do I support you and just pretend and now become an enabler because I'm not telling you what's really happening?
Yeah. Good question, John. Let's let our experts help answer it. And I'm so sorry for what you're going through, but I think you sound like a good brother. So let's ask Michael Wilson first. Mm-hmm. Siblings. We haven't talked about those siblings who may not be struggling with addiction, but are at least indirectly. Maureen, you had to deal with this as well in your own story. But what advice do you give families, Michael?
You know, I think he had a great point. Is trying to figure out the line between separating yourself from the addiction and being there for the person. You know, that my family had to go through that, and I've had to go through that with other family members, is, how close do I want to be? How helpful can I be by stepping in? Mm-hmm. How helpful is it for me to bring it up? Do I just pretend to be close to them? These are all questions that everyone has to answer for themselves. And, I know that for me, my siblings were the last ones to accept that I was getting well and forgive. They were the last ones to truly forgive me. They thought that... I was going to continue to be like that forever. That's all they had ever known of me.
How long were you like that?
16 years. So, I started when I was 14. That means my oldest younger sibling was 4. So basically for their whole life, that's all they saw. So when I finally got sober around 30, it was really hard for them to accept that I could be somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas my parents held on to the hope forever, my siblings were more likely to just give up and take a step back and accept that this is the way things were.
Right. Maureen, how as a parent did you handle that whole sibling issue?
It was difficult, and each certainly I have 4 children, and each one of them dealt with it differently, but I have an amazing young man for a son who's 23 right now, and watched this go on with his sister, and they were very, very close. And he... I don't think he knew what he was doing while he was doing it, but he basically met her where she was. So there was never a point where he didn't reach out and tell her he loved her. And that was my philosophy too. This doesn't keep me from loving you. You may not be able to be in my house. I may not be able to give you any money, but I can love you and I can tell you I love you at every opportunity. And he did the same thing. He never at any point turned his back on her. And I think one of the things that made her keep wanting to get well.
Yeah, right. So I guess
there's only so much you can do. I mean, as a brother, he can't. What is he going to do? She's in California. He loves her. That may be the thing that he can do is continue to remind her how loved she is.
All right. I want to take another call here. Caitlin is on line one.
Hi.
Hi, Katie. You're on the air.
Hi, Mom.
Oh my goodness.
We didn't know she was calling.
I've been trying to call for like an hour.
Yeah, I know. Our lines are jammed, Katie. So what do you want to... Your mom has told your story so beautifully in her book. Your mom has created this support group for families around the country, really, to help families. Katie, what's your message to our listeners who are calling here and they're saying, the system is kind of broken, but we're doing the best we can, and here you are, a success story. What do you tell us, Katie, to inspire us?
I think the most important thing is to never lose hope, because even when I lost hope, my mom didn't, and I think that's why I'm still here today. So, be supportive. Don't enable. I always tell her, thank you for not enabling me, but supporting me at the same time and never giving up on me.
Well, I don't think there's a dry eye in this studio, Katie. So I appreciate it. And it must have been hard, though, not to be able to live at home and live with your family. I mean, I think that must have been a difficult thing. Was it? You wouldn't have said this 2-3 years ago that thank you, Mom, for not letting me stay home, I bet.
No, I used to ask her to leave me alone. I'm like, why won't you just leave me alone? And she would say, well, that's not going to happen. So,
well,
I'm very grateful today that she didn't leave me alone.
And what was it? What was it, do you think, Katie, that made you say, I can't do this anymore. I need to make a change.
Like towards the end, I just kept overdosing and overdosing. Like I think 4 in 1 week, and just way more than that. But I think eventually, like, I realized that, like, God didn't want me to die, and I had to keep going, like, learning the hard way, and I just, like, finally just stood up and had enough.
Well, good God. For you. And 20 months, I understand, and things are going well.
Yep, things are going really awesome. Well.
All right.
Mm. You know, we just got lucky, too. Any of those times she could have passed away. Right. And that, I think, is the huge difference between her and maybe somebody else, because I think given enough time and support, everybody would get well. It's just, unfortunately, some people run out of luck.
Right. Katie? You are an inspiration to all of us, and thank you so much for calling and joining in the conversation today. And keep up the good work, okay?
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. I want to not be emotional. So very good work, Maureen, very good work. But I want to bring another voice into the conversation as well, because this is sort of a controversial idea. It's this idea of harm reduction, that people can maybe use drugs sometimes to reduce the harm and maybe be safe. And it might be the definition of recovery for some folks. So Jess Tilley is on the line. She's executive director of the New England Users Union, and that's a group that fights for the rights of drug users. Jess, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi.
I'm wondering, Jess, if you can tell us a little bit about harm reduction, this notion of harm reduction in recovery, and what it means for you.
So I wanted to kind of add, because it wasn't that your definition was wrong, but it was a little bit what the dominant culture sees harm reduction as, and that's not what it is.
Okay, well, well, correct me, please.
Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. You're the expert.
So harm reduction is more the idea that people are going to use. We noticed the Just Say No campaign was a terrible failure. Coming out of the drug war that we have in this country, which is what I truly believe is killing people, was the idea that we can keep people safe while they're using. Actually, it started in the height of the AIDS epidemic. CDC, Department of Public Health, were at a loss because we were losing so many people. So they turned to the community of people that were being affected. It's the same with drug users. As was mentioned earlier, we say we're in an epidemic, but this epidemic has been going on for decades. Mm-hmm. The idea was, if we provide the tools, if we treat people as human beings, truly meet them where they're at, and love them, that we can save lives. And people will come to a point. I've been listening, and I identify as, don't say I'm in recovery, because there's also this idea that only 12-step recovery works. Mm-hmm. We're losing people in the gap between, been such pushback between the harm reduction community and the recovery community, and unfortunately we're losing so many people in between. Recovery is a full spectrum for people. Mm-hmm. I've been in 12-step where when I said I was on MAT, I was told that I was not quote-unquote clean, which pushed me out of the rooms and kept me using for years. Mm-hmm. And I see that happen to so many people. I work with so many parents.
And it happens still, do you think, Jess, that still, even though now folks seem to be coming around to this idea of using medication to treat addiction, you think that there are many recovery programs or treatment programs or recovery communities that don't allow people to be using medication?
Exactly. I see it every day, especially here in Western Mass. It's gotten better, and I still attend meetings occasionally. I bring people to meetings. But as you heard, there are treatment facilities that you cannot be on medication, and I've seen people die because of that. Mm-hmm. We definitely need to look at every alternate route. Mm-hmm. Again, harm reduction is not, the magic bullet, but it's definitely keeping people alive. And people will reach that point, mm-hmm. People who are using, where they say enough is enough. Unfortunately, we still have some that is never going to happen. And what we can do is keep them safe and alive and love them.
Okay. Michael Wilson, react to that. What do you think? Is that an option that we need to maybe reconsider in some cases for some folks because someone can't recover if they're not alive?
Well, I mean, I hear constantly that, all forms of recovery have to be available. All forms of treatment should be an option. I mean, we actually run a abstinence-based 12-step sober living for men, which we don't allow people to be on MAT, specifically so that people who may have a history abusing those medications don't have to be in a house with other people who are taking them. Mm-hmm. And just like I think people who want to take MAT should have a place to do it safely. I think the people who don't should also have a place to get well safely or to choose abstinence-based recovery if that's what they want. I mean, 12 steps is what helped get me well, but I don't push that on everyone I work with. It's, you know, whatever works for them. But I definitely think there should be, you know, all paths toward recovery should be available.
Mm-hmm. I want to make sure we take another call here. Heidi is calling from Gloucester. Heidi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm just calling to add some comments about the treatments that are available for people struggling with addiction. My personal experiences with my son, and he's now been clean for 6 months, thank God. But over the past 5 to 7 years, it took us to get to this point. There was like a 24-month period of time where he was using actively, and he was seeking treatment. He wanted to stop, and I would take him to detox after detox. I counted at one point that I had taken him to 17 detoxes in a 24-month period.
Wow.
And our health insurance was excellent. I had Blue Cross Blue Shield, and they were very happy to cover all of these 5-day detoxes, but I could not get them to cover anything beyond that. So he would come out of detox and maybe be clean for a week or two, or maybe sometimes a little bit longer, and then he would relapse, and we would go right back into that same detox cycle. So I think something really needs to change about, you know, the what is offered for covered programs for these people.
Well, I think I want to ask Dr. Potee, what's the obstacle, Doctor? I mean, everyone keeps saying, we hear this over and over again, we've heard this from almost every caller, everybody says, we need long-term care, we can't do these short detoxes, we need more than a month, we need more than 14 days. So why don't we do it? I mean, if that's what will work, why aren't we doing it? Is it money?
Yeah, everything always comes down to money, and it costs money to have people in structured long-term sober care. And it's not well funded, as you can imagine. Having said that, there's a lot of money being made in addiction care these days, and with the lawsuit that is taking place in this state and other states against Purdue Pharma and some of the other manufacturers of opiates that were overprescribed and pushed on prescribers in the last 20 years, one would like to believe that the money, were there ever money coming out of the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma, would go back to help people with long-term recovery. I think about the caller who just called in, and her story is just so heartbreaking. The notion that anybody would think 5 days and you're better and go back home and figure it out works. It just, my experience is that rarely works. And Essex County, where Gloucester is, has the same opiate problem that the rest of us have. It's bad everywhere in New England, except the treatment availability in Essex County is quite low. It has the lowest treatment options. There should be a low barrier to access treatment. It should be easy. You should be able to walk into a methadone clinic within your neighborhood any day and get treatment. You should be able to walk into your primary care office and say, wow, I'm in a big mess and I need you to help me. And most primary care doctors should be able to do their job and take care of people with addiction. And that doesn't happen. And instead, people show up in the ER and every ER sends them out and treats them badly while they're there without having started them on any medicine, a warm handoff.
Well, that is supposed to change, right? Right, that is supposed
to change. That is changing, although there's a lot of resistance from both the ER doctors, but also they need a warm handoff. They need to have a place where these patients they start can go. And in many communities, that's not available. Now, you are kind about Western Mass. We have built Western Mass to be a place where you can get better. And I have to say, your expert on the phone about harm reduction is spectacular because I want people to stay alive, and I love hearing Katie's voice, and there was no dry eye in my office either hearing her voice, Maureen's fabulous daughter. But we know that relapse is common. We know that relapse is actually to be expected, and if I can get somebody at 6 to 12 months who's likely to relapse to be able to do it in a safe injection house where somebody there can keep them alive if they overdose, if we know it's going to happen, why would we ever allow people to actually die, right? If we know that relapse between 6 and 12 months is so common because people feel better, they feel normal, they want to dip their toe in, let's have an opportunity so that they can do it in a place where they can be kept alive. That should be happening in the progressive fine state of Massachusetts.
Right. And you know, unfortunately, we are running out of time. So I think I'm going to give the last word to Maureen because of that beautiful phone call from your daughter. And we're looking for, we have really just about a minute and a half left here, but for hope here. We've heard a lot about the problems in the system. What do we, what when you look ahead, do you say, I'm hopeful that this won't continue into the next generation?
I mean, if you can hear her voice, right, this is not the person that she was 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's possible for everybody that is suffering right now, that's caught in that cycle, to turn this around and have that beautiful life that she has right now and hold on to it. And we need to do that in every way possible. I couldn't agree more. And we need to connect with each other, too. We're much stronger. There's strength in numbers, which is why Magnolia has these support groups for parents that are seeking, you know, that connection with other people. And we have to get behind the harm reduction. We have to get the longer periods of time for care, too. Okay. That's going to make the difference.
Maureen Cavanaugh, author of If You Love Me, that tells the story of her family dealing with her daughter Katie's addiction. She's also founder and president of Magnolia New Beginnings. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Also, Michael Wilson, director of family services for Bay State Recovery Services and author of the book Loving Lions. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Ruth Poteet, thank you so much for joining us from Western Mass.
Thanks, Deborah.
And Jess Tilley, you too. Thanks for bringing up an important perspective in this topic.
Thanks, Deborah.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.